Hey guys, before we get started with the podcast today, I just have a couple of housekeeping notes. So I said in episode zero, we don't want to put out a podcast that's an hour long. And if we have interviews that go that long, then we're going to split them into two. And what I'm finding is that most of my interviews are going an hour long. And so what we're going to do is split those into two halves. And the first half will be released on Tuesdays, and the second half will be released on Thursdays. So it's a weekly podcast in terms of theme that's split into two different episodes. And what would be really helpful for us, if you want to stay up to date on everything that's going on, then please go into iTunes and subscribe, or wherever it is you get podcasts, and subscribe. That way, when we release them, they're scheduled to go out early in the morning. And when you wake up, it'll be right there in your queue. And so you can listen to the podcast on your way to work, or on your way home from work, you know, whenever. You don't have to worry about going and finding it. It's right there waiting for you. And so that's it. I just want you to know what to expect with the podcast release going forward, and then just to encourage you to go out and subscribe. All right, hope you enjoy the rest of our conversation with Jared Bingham on Chattanooga 2.0.
This isn't an entity. Chattanooga 2.0 is an entity or a program. It's a community movement. So, you know, I think a large part of the success of 2.0 will hinge on the community's willingness to do some of these things that are outside our comfort zone.
Welcome back to our conversation with Jared Bingham. Last week, we started discussing Chattanooga 2.0, a new countywide effort that explores ways in which we can begin to connect the people of Hamilton County to the various opportunities. And Chattanooga 2.0 is more than just K-12 reform. As Jared described it, the scope is cradle to career, from pre-kindergarten services to post-secondary credentialing. And today, we will discuss some of the specific challenges that the report and the community has revealed, and some of the potential hopeful solutions. This is the Camp House Podcast, and I am your host, Matt Busby. One of the more sobering realities of the statistics that are given in the report revolves around the distribution of low-performing schools among the poorest neighborhoods in Chattanooga. In fact, the report highlights that an African-American student in Hamilton County is 33 times more likely than a white student to attend a high school that ranks in the bottom 5% of the state. Now, that seems like a very specific problem of inequality. Can you talk about what are the ideas going around right now? What has been mentioned? What's being thrown around to address this specific issue?
So one of the things to keep in mind is that system-wide, county-wide, a little over 60% of Hamilton County students are on free or reduced lunch. So, I mean, poverty is a very, in some of our schools that are a little bit more challenged than others. And, you know, we tried to take an approach that we want to hear from the students. We want to hear from the parents. We want to hear from the business owners that live in these communities. Why do these challenges exist? What are the barriers that you're finding that prevent your child or prevent you as a student from accessing these opportunities that other middle-income or upper-income families enjoy? Because as we started going out and having these sessions, because we have some at the schools, we'd have some at different community centers, and start talking to people, we would hear this repeatedly. Well, it's great that people talk about all these opportunities in Hamilton County, but we just can't access them. You know, we're doing good to get our kids through the school day, much less start thinking about college, you know, 10 years from now, or a industry certification. So it really boiled down to wraparound services and how do we support families outside the classroom so that when they come to school, they can come ready to learn and they're not dealing with these emotional, physical, environmental issues that prevent them from having a quality education.
Well, I want to come back to this here in a minute, but you did touch on something that that I want to bring up, and that is, you know, there's actually a lot of studies out there that show, it doesn't really matter for a student. It doesn't so much matter what the curriculum is, how good their teacher is, what school they're going to, as much as parental involvement. Like, there's a lot of studies out there that show that parental involvement is one of the number one factors in a child's education, and they're being able to judge whether or not that child's going to be a success. So can you speak to that? Number one, do you agree with that as a professional? And then how do we as a community address that more fundamental issue?
Yeah. So I think sometimes people give parents too bad of a rap. I mean, I've actually been in some feedback sessions where it feels like that, well, if we just got a different set of parents, you know, we're going to have better outcomes. But the reality is that most parents want what's best for their children, but it's, you know, logistically impossible at times mm-hmm. to help support that. You know, if they're working two or three jobs, or if they're single parent homes, or don't have the resources to be able to connect their child to some of the opportunities that other families can. So, you know, I would agree that parents as a support system is important. I would disagree with maybe the belief that some people have that if you've got students that aren't performing well, or you've got schools that seem to have more challenges than others, it's because of disengaged parents or parents that just don't care. I think it's more about how do we support parents around some of these wraparound services and around accessing resources than it is just, well, they don't, you know, they've got a laissez-faire approach to education.
Explain what you mean by a wraparound service. Give us an example of what that is.
Sure. So that's everything from making sure students have enough to eat when they're not at school, because some kids, the only, you know, nutritious meal they get is the breakfast and lunch they get at school. It's making sure that they are in an environment where they feel physically safe, feel emotionally safe. We've got avenues for them to access counseling if they need to, because, you know, honestly, in some of our more challenging schools, kids see more traumatic things, they experience more traumatic things, but oftentimes we don't have the resources there to help them work through those issues. So it's also, you know, just things like clothing. I mean, sometimes we take for granted that just anecdotally, it was just last week, someone was talking about a story of they had seen a student in this past winter without a jacket, gave that student a jacket, and a couple of days later came to school, noticed on a real cold day that he wasn't wearing the jacket, and said, "What happened to the jacket we gave you?" He said, "Oh, I had to give it to my brother." Wow. And so, you know, when students are battling things like that, it's pretty hard to concentrate on Pythagorean's theorem when, you know, they're not clothed and fed.
Sure. Well, I want to go back to this issue that it seems to be our lowest performing schools, especially when it comes to middle and high school, are within the poorest neighborhoods of Chattanooga, too. You know, almost a year ago, the radio show This American Life released a two-part episode called The Problem We All Deal With. Are you familiar with that episode?
I've listened to it a couple of times, yeah.
Right. Tell me about your thoughts on that episode, because basically this episode is talking about what is far more powerful than education reform is actually integration. And we definitely have schools in Hamilton County District that are 95% plus minority students. And we have other schools that are going to be well over 80 to 90% white students. So can you speak to that? Is that a possible solution for us?
Sure. And to be clear, you know, it's not just about racial integration. It's also socioeconomic integration. What we see is that students who are able to interact within their education environment with other students on various income levels, socioeconomic levels, they do better than when it's a homogeneous makeup. So when we look at Hamilton County, there is some definite socioeconomic segregation, it appears, if you just look at the data. And unfortunately, that it also closely aligns with racial segregation on appearance. So the conversation was started this past year. I know Unify Ed hosted a conversation about socioeconomic integration and what that would look like in our schools, and is that a possible solution? You know, and we've said from the beginning, all solutions are on the table, hopefully open to all ideas, and we're going to have to be bold, and we're definitely going to have to get out of our comfort zones. And so when you get out of your comfort zone, that typically means you're going to ask some hard questions, not only of others, but of yourself, and be willing to be a critical partner and say, you know, if we've got schools with 90-plus free and reduced lunch students, why is that? Why do we have, and why in these same schools is it over 90% students of color, whether that's African-American or Latino students? So it's definitely a conversation we should be having in the community. I think that the conversation has started. I know the Metro Ideas Project, they've also brought that conversation to the forefront. So at the end of the day, you know, heterogeneous makeups of students is always going to be a more rich experience for all the students involved. And I think, you know, in This American Life, that episode or the two episodes, that they highlighted it pretty candidly, that, you know, but also highlighted how you've got certain pockets of our population in this country that still would be very adverse to their children going to school with children of poverty.
Right, right. And I think I do wonder if Chattanooga 2.0 has flown under the radar a bit because they haven't, because there aren't explicit reform ideas yet. And I feel like, and I think you mentioned this at the end of the report, the really hard work is actually still in front of us. That it hasn't even begun yet.
Yeah, it's easy to diagnose an ailment, you know, but the treatment is usually what is the more challenging task. And this sounds cliche, but I tell people the work isn't ended at the 100 days. It's just beginning. And the heavy lift is in front of us, because it's now that we've co-constructed these strategies, people are going to look to see, where you actually going to act on them? Are you going to act on what I say? Or is this just another opportunity where I went, you wrote my information on butcher paper hanging on the wall, and then we all went home? So I think there will be a lot of eyes on us after we release the report. And but, you know, this isn't an entity. Chattanooga 2.0 isn't an entity or a program. It's a community movement. So, you know, I think a large part of the success of 2.0 will hinge on the community's willingness to do some of these things that are outside our comfort zone.
I was going to say this question at the end, but you kind of brought it up now, so let's go ahead and ask it. Let's say Chattanooga 2.0 and all the research you guys have done, all the forums you've hosted, comes up with a few very clear action plans. What's the process for implementing those? Is it something that the community votes on, that the school board votes on? Who's going to oversee the implementation of these ideas? I guess, you know, going forward over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, who's responsible for accountability in this thing?
Sure. So, you know, the school board is definitely a partner in this work. The school board chair, Jonathan Welch, has been on the steering committee from the beginning. The school board voted to approve a resolution to support Chattanooga 2.0 as this moment in time for the community to come together and come up with strategies. And I know in the recent strategic plan for HCDE that Dr. Kelly, the interim superintendent, put together as a budget proposal to the county commission was around the 2.0 strategies that had bubbled to the surface at that point. So, the you know, obviously the school board will be an important partner in just blessing any strategies to be within the K-12 spectrum that they're implemented there. But it's also going to require some philanthropy to get involved, and organizations to get involved just with sweat equity to implement some of these programs. Some of them are zero-sum budget that we could do with some of the resources we have in place. It just may mean a realignment of resources or manpower. So, you know, at the end of the day, people always come back and say, well, is this going to cost us more money? Where will that money come from? You know, how are you going to pay for it? Does this mean a tax increase? We've never set out to say 2.0 is about, you know, a tax increase to fund education initiatives. We set out to say we need to see where the challenges are in the community. What's the community identifying as the challenges? What are the solutions that the community is putting forth to address these challenges and make them very bold and aspirational? Figure out where we need to go, kind of the man on the moon moment for Hamilton County. And then once we, you know, set those objectives, then figure out how to get there.
Right. So turning to the community to figure out these ideas. You said earlier, we just, as of today, the 100 days, kind of the period, the incubation period you guys set out for to explore this, to host community forums and panel discussions and stuff. That's all just ended. And I noticed on your website, you guys have released, was a, for each one of these, so each one of these categories of early childhood education, K to 12, and then post-secondary credentialing slash career development. You, one of the big questions is, what are the biggest challenges for each one of those? And then what are the big ideas? So can you tell me what are the big challenges? Can you give me one example of a big challenge for each one of those three categories that you guys found in your research over the past 100 days?
Sure. So in early childhood, for instance, one of the glaring challenges is that we're about 1,000 seats short in pre-K of being able to offer pre-K to all rising kindergartners if parents wanted that option. So universal pre-K has kind of been at the forefront of the conversation of how do we at least offer quality early childhood programs to any and all students who and parents that want to access that. But it doesn't have to be, you know, within the HCD pre-K program. It's about how do we support faith-based institutions or private early childhood organizations just to make sure we have quality across the spectrum. So just access to more seats in early childhood, quality seats. In K-12, literacy is just a huge stumbling block that we see early on in elementary grades that has this ripple effect throughout their entire experience. So when you look at approximately 40% of our third graders are on grade level, and then you look at approximately 40% of our eighth graders are on grade level in math and reading, and then approximately 40% of our graduates are meeting college and career ready benchmarks, and then 40% are going on to obtain a post-secondary credential. That
it's a very common number.
Yeah,
there.
It's a pretty eye-opening data point that has this ripple effect mm-hmm. throughout their education experience. So literacy is at the forefront in K-12. And then post-secondary is just helping students complete a program. We're just not doing a good job in our community right now of helping students navigate the system. I mean, a lot of people don't know, I went to Chattanooga State for 2 years. Okay. I went there to play basketball. I was on the team more than actually playing basketball, but I remember calling my dad almost daily for the first month just to get his what do I go down here to my advisor
right.
to do, you know, to help navigate the system. And luckily I had that support system yeah. in place, but many kids don't. So within post-secondary, it's just helping students complete more credentials than we yeah. are right now.
Yeah. So I guess a similar question there, you know, you talked about that we're about 1,000 seats short for the preschool, if we're going to have, you know, enough preschool spots available for people who want them. I guess on the other side of that spectrum, are there enough seats, enough programs, enough openings when it comes to career credentialing out there? And I say this as a bit of a confession. My wife right now is applying for a program at Chat State, and it's a program that over 100 people apply for and only about 32 get in. That's a very real question for me right now. Out there in Hamilton County, do we have enough programs out there to get these credentials for people who want them?
Yeah, sure. So I think we have enough programs, but it goes back to the seats within those programs, especially at the TCAT, which is housed at Chattanooga State, the Tennessee College of Applied Technologies. We've got 16 of those across the state, and one of them's housed at Chattanooga State. And, you know, they have over 90% of their students complete programs that enroll, and then they've got over 90% job placement for their graduates. So, it's a great program that gets great results, but seats are limited in most of those programs. So you've got cohorts of like 20 students maybe in some of these programs. So that's one of the areas of expanding TCAT opportunities, credentialing opportunities down in the high schools, helps offer more broadly, at least for students. Now for adults, you know, it's still a challenge to make sure we've got enough seats, but definitely bringing back some of those credentialing opportunities in high school will help.
So you also, within this time frame, and this is all on your website on Chattanooga 2.0, but you list some of the three challenges, but then you also list three bold ideas that have come out of these 100 days of research for each one of these categories. I want to hear one bold idea for each one of these categories that you're excited about, that you could see as being potential as something that, yeah, we can do this as a community.
Sure. So I won't get too specific because we want to make sure that the integrity of the report is maintained. But, you know, from a 30,000-foot view, I can definitely say one of the things we've looked at in early childhood is how do we provide multi-generational opportunities for parents that have children that are birthed to 4 years old. So can we offer child care to these adults so that they can go back and earn a credential at the same time, possibly at the same facility. So really, this multi-generational approach is kind of new even nationally. So if we could figure out a way to make that happen in our community so that we're supporting, especially young adults who may not have had those support systems right out of high school to obtain a credential, that they can have their child taken care of in a quality program while they're simultaneously earning a degree as well. So that's one area. The second area is in teacher prep. We've enjoyed a very good relationship with UTC through this process, and they just hired a new director of the College of Education. So how do we make sure we're creating pipelines in Hamilton County with the very best teachers possible, and we retain those teachers over a longer period of time? So Hamilton County hires about 300 new teachers every year.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a substantial number. So how do we make sure we're getting quality? So teacher prep is an area I've been really excited about, and Dr. Renee Murley is that new director of teacher education. And so I know that UTC has been very involved, and they're also excited about this partnership, that or potential partnership with the district, and creating a really robust teacher prep pipeline. And then in post-secondary workforce, this may sound mundane in some ways, and it's definitely not a sexy strategy, but a website similar to Job Hub type website that we're going to develop where residents can go and say, okay, you tell me about all these opportunities are out there, but I don't know where to find them. And this
huge need.
Yeah. So this would help connect residents to the opportunities out there. And by the way, how you get credentialed for these opportunities, and not only how you get credentialed, but what are the industry demands right now, the projected demands? Because one thing we found that especially big employers in the community have become so cynical almost at recruitment of new employees, that especially entry-level positions, that they take any and all that they can get, because a very small percentage of those applicants actually can make it on to like the interview process, the interview stage. So what we wanted to do is maybe provide more quality than quantity. So get employers to be really specific when you say, oh, we'll take all of that certain applicant that you can send us. Well, they really mean 10. So do you want us to still send you 200 and you get 10 that actually rise to the top, or would you rather have 15 quality applicants to pick from that you know have the credentials? So getting employers to be pretty transparent about what their hiring needs are going to be and what credentials they're going to look for in those applicants.
One of the, when we were talking about the early childhood education big idea and having this almost holistic experience of a mother being able to take her son or daughter to childcare and still at the same time, you know, go ahead and finish a degree or find credentialing. And what I'm wondering about with the K-12 is how much of this has been a conversation, if it's a conversation at all. When I was in Florida, I helped open a K-8 school. And what's fascinating about the Chattanooga 2.0 report, and it looks like it's this way across the state, is that you see these wonderful gains in elementary school all the way up to fifth grade. And then once they enter into middle school, the stats just kind of confirm for everybody that middle school is the dark ages, and they just plummet. Is there any kind of conversation along those lines of, because my experience with the K-8 model is it keeps these kids in this very nurturing environment through one of the hardest times of their life. They're not getting thrown into a new environment. They're there with the same teachers they've had since they were little, you know, since they were children. I'd love to hear your ideas on that, if that's been a discussion at all.
Yeah. So I was also a middle school science teacher, so I know what I can relate to the dark ages that you speak of. And middle school is a, you know, it does take a substantive nosedive when you look at the literacy and the math results in sixth through eighth grade, but that's a statewide trend, as you mentioned. And there's a couple of reasons, I think, for that. One is that when we changed academic standards in Tennessee a few years ago that were more robust, they were the higher expectations, they're more challenging, that you didn't have as many content experts within middle school as you need. So, you know, when I was getting my teaching license, I don't know how when you were in Florida, but I just got a general K-8 elementary license. And so I could teach anything K through 8, and whether I was good at math or not, I could teach it. And so you've got some teachers that were, say, teaching math for 10 years under our old standards and didn't really need to be a content expert because it wasn't that challenging, to be honest. We had some of the lowest standards in the country. But when we made that shift to more rigorous standards, we found that we had a pretty significant portion of our middle school teaching population that weren't content experts enough to actually teach these standards with fidelity. So that's one challenge, is making sure we've got content experts, subject matter experts in middle school. The other part is just that emotional, hormonal development period, you know, because it's not an anomaly to Hamilton County. You see that nosedive, you know, when you look at the statewide data, there's this significant drop off in achievement. So it does make us look at, you know, again, what are some of those possible wraparound services we could do in middle school to make the environment more conducive to learning? Or, you know, it's even brought up in some of the meetings, should we look at junior high models again and more K-8 environments? I was a former 7-12 principal, which is a pretty unique situation, but so I can relate to that. Having consistency longer definitely helps.
So education reform is a really, really big initiative. It involves an enormous amount of people, from administration to teachers to students to parents, and hopefully large swaths of the general community. But it also involves politics and a very large budget. In the end, you know, what gives you hope that we can actually make this happen?
Well, when we started down this journey, you know, we were not naive to the fact there'd been a Blue Billion education initiatives in Hamilton County already. So we felt like that if this was going to be a different moment in time, we need to make sure we had policymakers at the table. We need to make sure parents, business leaders, students, everyone was at the tables. And we have had great engagement from our policy, local policymakers. We've had, you know, our school board members are on some of the committees. The county mayor is on the steering committee. The city mayor is on the steering committee. We've had county commissioners that are on the work teams and the committee. So our elected officials have really engaged in this work from the very outset. The county commission voted 9-0 to approve a resolution to support Chattanooga 2.0 in this conversation. So I think having everyone involved in the process is a key to it, because it's more of a challenge if you go somewhere in a dark room and create a set of strategies, and then you bring them back to policymakers and say, okay, we really want you to buy into this, even though you weren't part of the process. So I think that's what's different this time, is that, you know, we've really tried to do community engagement in an authentic way and have everyone at the table.
The report actually mentions, what if we could make Chattanooga the smartest city in the South? What if Chattanooga became known not as a center of technology and innovation, entrepreneurship, not as a scenic city, but as the smartest city? Can you talk about Chattanooga 2.0 as the dream of Chattanooga becoming the smart city?
So when we released the Chattanooga 2.0 report and we had this phrase, smartest city in the South, people tended to default to K-12 and thought, oh, that means we're going to have higher test scores, when really it's about making smart decisions as a community around infrastructure, around post-secondary workforce development, around wraparound services that we provide to families. So it's not just about education. That's definitely an integral component of it. But to me, smartest city or smartest community is about the decisions we make to bridge the opportunities to accessing those opportunities from birth to a job.
There's this blog post in Chattanooga that was written, I think, 5 years ago now, called The Two Chattanoogas. And what it is it's basically describing and explaining how, yes, on the one hand, Chattanooga is beautiful and thriving and flourishing for a certain segment of people. But on the other hand, we have this entire part of our community that is caught in a cycle of poverty, and that hasn't changed in a very long time. I feel as if Chattanooga 2.0 is trying to address that issue in an indirect way. Can you talk about that? How does investing in our education system, be it early childhood education, K-12, post-secondary credentialing, how does that improve the quality of life of Chattanooga in general?
Yeah, so it's absolutely about bridging the gap between the opportunities that are out there and a student or family's ability to take advantage of those opportunities. So when we look at this, we look at it very holistically of birth to a job. What do we need to do to support families who have school-age children, or what do we do to support families that have children that are 2 or 3 years old, or what do we do to support families that where the parents want to go back to school to get a credential to be able to access some of these opportunities that are out there. So, you know, it's the word bridge just keeps coming to my forefront of my mind as I have conversations with people. It's really about how do we build bridges so that families can access where they are to the opportunities that are out there.
I love thinking about Chattanooga 2.0 in this way, because something that Chattanooga I feel like is criticized for is having a lot of opportunity, but that opportunity being limited to a certain section of society. And this feels like Chattanooga 2.0, more than just improving literacy and improving math, is actually speaking to that larger problem.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we had Dr. Tiffany Anderson that came, very successful superintendent in St. Louis, that turned around a school district very similar in challenges that Hamilton County has and Chattanooga has. And she kept speaking about hope, and it, you know, as a principal's son and also a Baptist choir director's son, my daddy always made sure I either had an academic standard for every situation or a scripture for every situation. So as she was speaking, I just kept thinking about the scripture verse that joy cometh in the morning. And we can talk about, you know, the opportunities, and, you know, we can celebrate and have this joy about prosperity that part of Chattanooga enjoys. But really, when I think about that verse, it's that hope that sustains people till the joy comes. And so I think 2.0 is really a conduit to provide hope to some of these families that really haven't had it before, and that we're genuinely listening to them and helping address their challenges so that they can feel like this is a different day, and that hope can carry them to some of these opportunities. Yeah, so I think that anytime you have a new initiative or a new conversation or a movement, it can do one of two things. It can either divide people more by who's in the conversations and who's leading the charge, or it can bring people together. And I feel like that, you know, this is a real opportunity with the stakeholders from across the community we've tried to include to really unite Chattanooga around some common strategies. And really to try to empower community members to help in their own communities. Because, you know, Jared Bigham can go down to some of these communities and volunteer time, or try to go in schools and help and bring, you know, strategies in. But at the end of the day, what has the most impact and is more sustainable is when community members are empowered to help bring about that change themselves. So I'm excited about this opportunity and really feel like that we've made an all-out effort to include as many voices from across the community as possible.
Do you see Chattanooga 2.0 and the reforms to our education system from cradle to career as being critical to our future as a city, as an economy, as a county, as a community?
I would agree with that, in the sense that there have been so many reform efforts and programs, quote unquote, in the community previously, that there's a certain bit of cynicism amongst some community members that, well, here we go again. So I think this is, for some people, you know, their last ditch opportunity. So, okay, I'll believe one more time, and I will get on board one more time. And I think if we fail those people, it could be a real turning point that would take a long time to recover from.
Knowing that that is a general sense within certain parts of the population in Chattanooga, can you speak to them and bring them on board? What would you say?
You know, my message would be that it's not about an initiative, and it's not about programs. It's about people, and it's not going to be a silver bullet plan. It's going to be a silver buckshot plan where we have multiple facets, and it's going to be unique to different communities. So be willing and hopeful that there's a strategy there for your community, there's a strategy there for your child, and there's a strategy to address some of the specific challenges that may be in your school or in the neighborhood that are impeding access to the opportunities that are out there. And it can't be done separately. It can't be, you know, some effort on the parent's part over here in isolation and then effort on other partners' part, that the school district or whoever it may be in isolation. It's got to be an effort working in concert together. You know, again, at the end of the day, an initiative has the potential to either bring people closer together or divide them further apart. So it's my hope and my belief that 2.0 can be a bridge for folks to work together.
All right, final question, Jared. It's Saturday afternoon. It's beautiful, 80 degrees and sunny. What are you doing in Chattanooga?
Oh, man. Well, I'm probably chasing one of my five children at, across Coolidge Park or Miller Plaza or somewhere, because my kids love the downtown area. They love visiting the aquarium and Discovery Museum. So I'm a daddy first above all things, so I love bringing my kids downtown.
Thank you so much.
Man, that's fun.
Thanks again to Jared for stopping in and talking to us about Chattanooga 2.0. If you want to learn more, or if you'd like to follow their progress, please head over to their website at chatt2.org. That's C-H-A-T-T, the numeral 2.org. And there you can sign up for their newsletter and to stay up to date and find out more about how you can get involved with this new initiative. And thank you for tuning into the Camp House podcast. You know, we want this to be a place where we explore a lot of the ideas and the people who are affecting our community and the culture of our city. And so if you've enjoyed this conversation about Chattanooga 2.0, then please head over to iTunes or wherever it is you get your podcasts and subscribe. And you can always share this episode or any of our future episodes from our website at thecamphouse.com/podcast. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you next week.